Blog Talk Radio.
Monster X Radio. I'm your host, Johnny Bigfoot, and with me tonight, as always, is my co-host, Shane.
Hello, everybody.
First of all, I'd like to take a moment to send our condolences to our past guest and a good friend, Steve Coles, and his family as they mourn the passing of Steve's brother, Bob, who recently had a heart attack. And I'd also like to take a minute to thank all the blogs and Facebook groups that have been supporting us and allow us to post our show on their sites. The Wars pages. You've got Bigfoot Wars, Sasquatch Wars, Bigfoot Battles, which is formerly the New Bigfoot Wars, Facebook Find Bigfoot, Zen Yeti, our friends over at the Janosqua Project, and Bigfoot Evidence, and the Bigfoot Network for blogging our shows. The Bigfoot Network is Sasquatch Nation, a.k.a. Racer X's new blog. And I'd also like to thank J. Michael Cooney, who is a cryptozoologist and author of Bizarre Zoology, and he's going to try and join us later in the evening as well. And Shane, would you like to introduce our guest?
Absolutely. All right. Well, our special guest this evening is an American cryptozoologist and a living pterosaur expert. He has written 3 nonfiction books on the subject of modern non-extinct pterosaurs, also known as pterodactyls, flying dragons, dinosaur birds, prehistoric birds, and non-bat featherless flying creatures. He's also been consulted for various production companies for television documentaries, including Destination Truth and Monster Quest. And so, without further ado, our guest tonight is Mr. Jonathan Whitcomb. Welcome, Mr. Whitcomb. Are you there? Oh, I don't see.
Let's see. Okay, I got him now. Let's see.
I'm
there
here.
He is.
Yeah. Thank you, Shane.
Oh, Absolutely. It's a great pleasure to have you here with us and for you to join us tonight.
Yeah, thank you. Great to be with you.
Awesome. So, Monster X here, we do a lot of different cryptids. We really steer towards, one of our, it was kind of founded on really Bigfoot, and that's kind of my general avenue of expertise. But pterosaurs have always fascinated me and a lot of our viewers. Do you mind telling us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure.
I
actually began seriously investigating this phenomenon of apparent living pterosaurs in 2003. I was interested because I got a phone call from Paul Nation from Texas, and he soon sent me in the mail some videotapes that he had made. Some of them were in around 2004, the others in 1994 and 2002. And I was fascinated by these videotapes from Humboldt Island in Papua New Guinea. That's how I got started, is just observing that. I was a forensic videographer working with attorney firms, independent, the legal video person. And that's how I got interested in the credibility of these natives who said they saw these creatures that they call ropin. And that's how I got started.
Wow. So how long have you been researching, pterosaurs and the like?
Well, it's been 10 years now. I had produced a very simple little short documentary called Searching for Ropin at the end of 2003. It didn't sell well because we didn't really know how to market it, but that's when Paul Nation got me interested in going on my own expedition. He'd been on two expeditions in Papua New Guinea searching for this creature that we believe are living pterosaurs. And I was fascinated, and I got all enthusiastic. I wanted to go myself. And eventually I did get my own expedition that I led a year later in 2004.
Wow. So how did that expedition go? Did you guys find any evidence? And who were you working with?
Well, that's a long story. I don't want to get too deep into things that are less interesting. But I led the first of two expeditions in 2004. There was another expedition that followed right after me, and this is at Umboy Island. The people there, the natives, call it Siasi. But Umboy is the home of this nocturnal animal that glows at night. It's a lot of traditions that the natives have about, but they're also eyewitnesses. And apparently it glows for a few seconds. And I was fascinated. I organized my own expedition, and I led it. I got there to Papua New Guinea in the fall of 2004, and I found an interpreter, and we went to Umboy Island from the mainland, and that's when I started interviewing people. And I could go into that if you want to hear about the natives' accounts.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I really would.
Yeah. The interesting things about these native accounts is they have their traditions and their legends, and we recognize them as superstitions about this animal they call ropin. And the superstition or the legend would go something like this. For example, the ropin flies around at night, and it looks for food. It goes off to the reefs, and it can change into a man, and then it can change its shape to go into a snake, and then the snake can change itself back into the ropin. But it's that's a superstition. But when you actually started interviewing people that are eyewitnesses, almost without exception, the eyewitnesses who are natives will not talk about their superstitious ideas at all, or about their traditions or legends. They'll just explain what they saw. In other words, they're good, credible witnesses that just describe their own personal experience. And maybe I can give you some examples of their particular with I was a videographer professional. I was hoping to get video of this incredible animal because I was pretty much convinced that it was a living pterosaur. So I went there, and it turned out I can only stay 2 weeks because of lack of funds, and the expenses were more than I thought.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't get the animal. We had some problems, and I was not able to get up all the way up to the to the mountain I wanted to get to, and there's just no real chance of finding this elusive nocturnal flying creature in these jungles. It's far more difficult than I thought, but I was able to interview three young men up in a remote village up near the mountain that's around the crater lake called Pung, P-U-N-G, Lake Pung. And this little village, I was fortunate to get this eyewitness and then two others that were with him. Should I go into that one?
Yes, please. What were the ages of these gentlemen?
When I met them in 2004, they looked around their early 20s. But the sighting itself was about 10 years earlier. So these men were, I had taken notes, but I think I'm afraid I mislaid them. But as I recall, they were in their late childhood, early teenage years at the time. And the seven of these boys went up, I call them boys, they went up to Lake Pung. It was the first time for Gideon. And they, as soon as they got there, there's nothing unusual, but within a few minutes, and this is in the middle of the day, clear weather, within a few minutes, this huge creature, they call it Ropen, huge creature came flying over the lake and fairly low altitude over the lake and just scared them terribly. I believe all seven of them ran home. The three that I interviewed, definitely they ran home in terror, absolute terror. And one of them was still nervous 10 years later as I was interviewing him. He was still nervous to talk about his experience. The creature, talked to Gideon first. I interviewed him, and I asked him how big was the wings. Now, he knows English. English is one of the three national languages in Papua New Guinea, but Gideon is not fluent in, of course, you don't expect him to be fluent in English. They use Tok Pisin and also their village language. But he wanted to answer all my questions in English, so I spoke to him mostly in English. I know very little Tok Pisin myself anyway. And I asked him about wings. What's the wings? How big are the wings? But see, when I said wings, he didn't notice that there was an S at the end of the word, so he thought I meant wing. And he said 7 meters, which is a huge wingspan. If it was a wingspan, but it was actually turned out to be, I believe, what he was telling me about one wing, because he made a drawing later, and the tail was the same length, basically similar length to one wing, and he said that the tail was 7 meters. So he estimated that the wingspan was such that I think it would be close to 45 feet or so, something in that neighborhood.
That's like a small Cessna.
Yeah, it was definitely a huge creature. There's no mistaking it. Maybe, Shane, I should go into a little bit about some of the ideas that have been floating around and thrown out by skeptics. One of them is about people are just misidentifying flying foxes. That's one of the oldest. I heard that way back in 2004, and I think it was already an old idea.
Mm-hmm.
But this is one of the examples. You see, these seven boys were terrified at this creature that was not a flying fox, because they would not have been scared of it. One of the things I did when I went up there was my interpreter and I handed out to particular special important personages, not everybody, but in special leaders in the villages, handed out these slingshots. The purpose of it is that they can more easily shoot the flying fox, fruit bats, and make them into soup, because they can make food out of them. And the people there would not misidentify something like a fruit bat. They would never be afraid of a fruit bat flying over a lake. That's kind of ridiculous. That's their dinner. You know, they're not afraid of dinner. The fruit bats can grow to at least 4 feet in a wingspan, I believe, maybe even a little larger. Some types are different species of fruit bats. The Tok Pisin language they use for that bat is Black Bokus, but in the local Kovai language, it's Byung. And the Ropen is a totally different name, it's a totally different concept. It's a nocturnal creature that has wings, no feathers. Gideon was absolutely sure there's no feathers. When I asked him about feathers, he gave me the strangest look, like there was something wrong with me. And he said, no feathers. He said in English, no feathers. But So sometimes people say that you use the word bird because that comes up as a flying creature that's not a bat, but it's not really a bird. It has no feathers.
Mm-hmm.
But these are three eyewitnesses that were there at the same time, the same same sighting in 1994. I interviewed them in 2004. So I can compare that with some other sightings if you'd like, because there are other sightings that are similar to that one.
Are you talking about in the Papua New Guinea area?
Yeah. Critical because a critical point about some of the sightings is they come from people from different cultures. Now, it was only people that were natives on Amboy Island, you know. There might be some type of doubt that come up, like, well, why are you telling these stories on this island? But there's actually other parts of Papua New Guinea, for example, that have very similar sightings. In 1944, I could tell you about Dwayne Hodgkinson. That's one of the probably most famous sighting in the last 100 years. It's one of the, what I call one of the four key sightings in the Southwest Pacific. In other words, the four pillars that give high credibility to the concept of modern living pterosaurs in the Southwest Pacific. Maybe we should go into that one.
Yeah, definitely. I was going to ask you a little bit real quick about the bioluminescence of the creature seen on, you know, seen in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, that's a long story. It's you probably write a whole book on that.
Yeah. Have you ever personally witnessed that?
No, I searched a lot at nighttime. What happened one night when I was on the outskirts of Gumlagan Village, my interpreter and I were out with some of the family of the local village leader. His name is Mark Cow. I spell it K-A-U. Mark Cow and my interpreter stayed up a little later than me. I got tired and went to bed. And just only about an hour after I got to bed, they saw the sighting of the rope and light. What they saw later and described to me was a glowing light that had the background of Mount Bell. Mount Bell is the largest mountain there, just not too far from Gumlagan Village. And they described it to me. It was a few seconds. But basically, that's very typical of the sightings of an Amboy Island. Now, this is not restricted to this little island at all. There's sightings all over the areas, islands around Papua New Guinea. I wonder maybe before we get into Hodgkinson and getting more into the bioluminescence, I should tell you about a British biologist earlier in the 20th century, because that's an important sighting that gives a kind of a background to what this is about. Her name was Evelyn Cheeseman. She was an entomologist, a biologist to study insects back in the early 20th century. In the 1920s and the 1930s, she went on a number of expeditions in the southern Pacific islands, including what we now call islands of Papua New Guinea. Back then, they just called it New Guinea. And she was on the mainland, what we now call the mainland of Papua New Guinea, or the eastern portion of the giant tropical island of New Guinea. And near Mondo, she had a sighting that she wrote about in a book that I was able to get some pages of that book. It's just a strange light that she saw for just a few seconds at a time, and then when that one light would go off, she'd see another one. Now, they were too bright to be... she didn't even mention the possibility of fireflies. It was too bright, too far a distance at that brightness to be anything like that. So she didn't even mention it in the possibility in her book. And she's a insect expert. And she said it doesn't seem reasonable to her that it could have been flashlights that the natives had been putting on and off, the electric torches, as the British call them, whatever they call them, the name for what we Americans call flashlights.
Yes.
She said it couldn't be that. It doesn't make sense because it would have to be natives all along a line about a mile or so long, putting on and off their flashlights for a certain time. It just didn't make sense, even if all those natives had all those flashlights. And also, it seemed to be coming from above the tree canopy. It just didn't seem to have any possibility of any human origin. And she eventually just gave up, and she wrote about it in her book. Now, the reason I mention that is because it's very close to the number of seconds, around 5 seconds or so, that the rope and light goes on and flashes on Amboy Island. I believe it's a related species, maybe even the same species. So this idea of bioluminescence is not just a narrow kind of little thing that a few people talk about. It goes down in history with a British biologist during them.
Fascinating. In your opinion, what would be the purpose of this bioluminescence?
Well, as best we can tell, there are several purposes. One of them is that you notice the light will come on for those few seconds, and it's a horizontal motion. You can see it; it's a horizontal flight almost, but a little bit on a downward angle. So it seems to be that the places that they flashed give you a clue. For example, I'd mentioned the one that was the background of Mount Bell. There's also another one instance where there's a tree that's out on the end of a peninsula on the northern side of the island, and the natives there on the northern side of Amboy describe the light flying down to that tree, and then it'll go out. Now, what they think, this is their idea. They think that the ropen is just waiting to see if anybody's watching it, and then when it feels safe, it will put on the light again and go down to the reef. What I think is that it's so consistent with this 5 or 6 seconds or so of flash. If I recall, I think it's 5 or 6 seconds, but it's so consistent all across the island, both north and south. I believe what happens is it's a very bright flash. It uses up its secretion or whatever the substance is that it uses to create the flash. It uses up its capacity within those seconds, and then it has to recharge that in the glands or whatever it has to create that biological chemical that makes that bright flash. So when it's finished with this flash, it could be landing on a tree or something. And so it needs to have light in order to safely land on a familiar place. But that's not the only reason it has a flash. It also flashes when it goes out over the reefs to search for giant clams or fish or whatever it eats on the reefs. So there's different purposes of it.
Gotcha, okay.
I have a question as far as pterodactyls go. Is that basically a subspecies then of a pterosaur?
Yeah, that's a good question, Johnny. It's a. I have to give you the normal answer that when people usually say pterodactyl. In certain countries, Western countries like the United States, probably Great Britain, Canada, probably Australia, we use the word pterodactyl in a generic sense. When we say pterodactyl, we mean the a primitive, prehistoric, featherless flying creature. And some of them had long tails, some of them didn't have tails or very, very short tails. And that's just kind of a generic layman's term. It's not a technical, scientific term in that sense. However, we need to be aware that also there is a particular species that was the first one discovered, I believe, in the late 1700s. That species discovered with the fossil. That fossil is called Pterodactylus or something like that, and so the word pterodactyl also scientifically has a very specific meaning. But generally, when people say pterodactyl, what they really mean is what the scientists call a pterosaur.
Okay.
Okay.
So I always use
more of a
pterosaur.
Common generic name.
Yeah, I prefer pterosaur because there's no question about what it means. Though I do use the word pterodactyl so that people can find a web page, for example, when they're looking for pterodactyl, because it's so common among non-scientists to use the word pterodactyl.
Okay. Interesting. Whereas in the common people, it's the opposite. Because I think everyone's heard the word pterodactyl, but I don't know if everyone, not many have heard the word pterosaur.
Yeah, so I still use that word in different web pages and so on, because I want to be sure that people can find me. Both of them are hard to spell. It's a silent P at the beginning,
Yeah.
That's very hard to spell. I mean, ropen is easy. Ropen, R-O-P-E-N. It's just a rope with an N at the end or a open with an R at the beginning. Ropen. And that's one of my web pages is www.ropens.com, but it's with a S, a plural. ROPENS.com. Yeah, and there's other names for it. Actually, we can talk more about Papua New Guinea, but there's sightings all over the world. But I like to talk about Papua New Guinea if you'd like to.
I'd like to cover a little bit of everything, especially some of the, you know, since this blog, you know, show is in the United States, some of the encounters here in the United States, and even more so, some of the more recent ones that people aren't aware of.
Yeah, there are recent ones. I get sighting reports fairly often, even sometimes once a week. But we go a little bit more into Papua New Guinea. There are sightings in the Philippines, too, and also Australia, and in all that region of the Southwest Pacific. So it's not restricted in any way. And we wouldn't expect it to be, really, because some of these creatures are quite large. Most of them are not big, but there are a few of them that are so large that when they're seen by anybody, native of Papua New Guinea or Australian or American, it's just a shocking, unforgettable experience because they're so large. But the biggest ones are just rare. They're just the older ones that have grown. I believe the best answer to all these different wingspans we have for the estimates is that at least some species, if not all of them, and there's more than one species alive on the Earth, I'm sure, at least one of them, they continue to grow as they get older. So you have some of them, many of them that are wingspan of 8 to 15 feet. You have some of them that are a wingspan up to 20, 25 feet, and you have very few rare ones that are over 30 feet in wingspan. Those are really rare, but they do come up in the sighting reports occasionally.
Now with that, though, do you... with Papua New Guinea specifically in that area,
yeah,
is there a specific type of pterosaur you think may be there? Because, you know, I'm thinking about the size, and I know that I think it's pronounced Quetzalcoatlus. I can't pronounce it.
Quetzalcoatlus.
Yes, thank you. That's the largest pterosaur, right?
Well, that's... yeah, and the fossil record, that's we always think about those. There's two basic types of pterosaurs in the fossil record. In the fossils, we have the long-tailed ones, which are called basal pterosaurs, a Rhamphorhynchoid, Rhamphorhynchus type. What they call basal pterosaurs are thought by many scientists to be older in the antiquities of way back millions of years. I don't believe it myself, but that's a popular idea. And those are long-tailed. The tail often has a flange, like a diamond or triangle kind of a shape at the end of the tail. And there's a difference in the way that the head is formed into the neck and so on, a different angle than the others. The larger ones, like Quetzalcoatlus, that are found in fossils of a very large size, those have very short tails, if they have any tail to speak of. And the head is in the way it's in a different angle on the neck. But what we find in modern reports of living creatures, or apparent living pterosaurs, which I believe they're valid sightings, is that most of them are what we call the basal pterosaurs, the long-tailed ones. So we have some sightings in which the people are so shocked by the general appearance in the head with the head crest that they don't even take notice of whether or not it had a tail. But many of the sightings do include a description of a long tail with a diamond at the end or a some kind of bulb shape at the end of it. Sometimes they call it a spade or a triangle or heart shape. One lady in Georgia described it like a heart shape on the one two of them that she saw. And there's definitely a very common sighting. In fact, it might be as much as a 4-to-1 ratio of the long tails compared to the ones that have short tails, at least 4-to-1.
So are there quite a few sightings of these in the Americas?
Yeah, most of the sighting reports I get now are in the United States. I haven't been back to Papua New Guinea since 2004. Because as soon as I got back and started publishing this, and from middle 2005 to the middle of 2006, I published my first book, Searching for Opens, the first edition of it. It took me 1 year, but even before I finished, I was getting lots of emails from people that said they saw similar creatures here in the United States. And as I got more and more reports, I wrote more books and more blog posts, and you know, that sort of got more response. Not all the reports I get are things that people saw recently. Some of them say, "Well, I saw this flying dinosaur many years ago, and I couldn't tell anybody, or nobody would believe me." And now, in recent years, we have all the information available online and the Google searching and so on. So people are now reporting things, sometimes are old and sometimes are recent. We can go into recent sightings in the United States of what appear to be ropings, if that would be a good direction to go now.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
Absolutely. I know that, you know, I've done a little bit of research, and it's pretty fascinating the amount of reports out there in the United States, specifically a few states in particular. Am I correct on that? Like Texas,
yes.
California.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot from California and Texas. I believe the reason is because the physical size of the states and the large populations of humans in Texas and California, it's not that pterosaurs like those areas any more than any other place. We just have so many people and so many different land areas that they could have a sighting, that we get more sightings in those two states. But we get them in, I think they're pretty much any of the 48 contiguous states you can get them. About half of them already have reports on, and there's no particular geographical clue to any kind of idea about any locations for them. They seem to be kind of spread out, and there may be different species, but I'll give you a common one, just for an example. It's a hypothetical example. Somebody will give me an email, say they saw a long-tailed featherless bird, and it looked prehistoric, and it had a diamond at the end of the tail, and it was 12 feet wingspan or something like that. Is a common kind of one. And it was the strangest looking thing, and they're shocked, and sometimes they doubt their sanity. Sometimes the eyewitness will just not know who to talk to, and they'll be afraid that they maybe had some kind of hallucination or something. Because some of these sightings are so close and so distinct, and that it's very shocking to the eyewitness, something outside of their whole teachings. There's a difference between Bigfoot and the type of work that my associates and I do with living pterosaurs. Bigfoot, I totally believe in Bigfoot. I have no doubts that there are such creatures in many places, including North America. But Bigfoot, we're not taught from kindergarten that all giant ape-like creatures became extinct millions of years ago. We are with pterosaurs and dinosaurs. So Bigfoot can be shocking, and people might not believe an eyewitness, but it's worse with a living pterosaur because our culture teaches us that they all became extinct many, many millions of years ago. And if you see one, you think you see one, you are in deep trouble, probably insane. And it's extremely difficult situation there. It's not as bad with Bigfoot. I mean, if I saw a Bigfoot, I wouldn't mind telling people about it. People probably will not think you're crazy. They might say that you misidentified something, or you're just spooked in the dark.
Great
point. They won't say that they won't say you're crazy, but they will with a living pterosaur.
Oh, absolutely. Just because of the with evolution being a factor, and most pterosaurs, you know, you're talking
Jurassic
Cretaceous.
Some people joke about it. They say, well, the pterosaurs, live pterosaurs, that's just what the Bigfoot rides around for, like an airplane, but make a joke like that. Just kind of put it all in one kind of category there so they can deal with it anyway. But yeah, the sightings are all across the United States, Florida. I mean, I could just name off the ones that I know where people have seen it. It just goes all around the whole country, Florida, Georgia. Let me tell you a sighting in the panhandle of Florida, western Florida, just less than a year ago. This is a professor, and he's agreed to have his name released, which I'm a jump for joy when that happens, because so many people want to be anonymous. His name is Stephen Waters with a W-A-T-T-E-R, Waters.
And awesome.
He was at home, I believe, in November. And he saw what he called a huge Rhamphorhynchus, he called it. And he was sure there's no feathers. He said it was so close when he was flying back by his house in the middle of the day, a quarter to 12 noon, late in the morning. It was so close that he could have shot it if he had a gun. he described details of it. He said there was a bulgy kind of thing at the end of the tail, long tail, and the thing at the end is very much like a diamond shape. And he observed it for a total length of time for several minutes, though I think the actual
wow.
close sighting, when it was like close to him, was probably not nearly that long. It flew off to a tree, and I think part of the sighting he was referring to those few minutes was actually when it was a little further off in distance, but it got close, and he described it in detail. No question, he said there was a neck. Now, he had looked online, and I asked him about this because there are misidentifications we have to look into. He said, there's no way it's a frigate bird. There's no way, because a frigate bird has no neck, no apparent neck. And if you've ever seen a picture of a frigate bird, you know what I mean. It looks like there's just no neck at all. The head is just stuck right there onto the body and the wings. But this thing did have a neck.
Now, was this sighting close to the ocean by chance?
Well, it's Crestview. I'm trying to remember a picture of the map. It has to be pretty close because it's in the panhandle of Florida.
Right.
It's around some water. There's plenty of water in that area. There's no question. Fresh
yeah,
water and
I'm looking
water.
At it right now. It's close to the Blackwater River State Forest because I was thinking the panhandle has a lot of big cities, but it also has these. It has the Apalachiola National Forest and the Blackwater River State Forest, which is right by Crestview. Which isn't that close to the ocean, but it's close to the Air Force Base.
Yeah, it was right close to there. And I think I saw on a map there is a reservoir somewhere, but you know, a lot of places near cities should have a reservoir.
I was going to say the reason I asked that is because I know there's been some really fascinating reports that have come out of Cuba.
Yes, that's incredible. We have to talk about that because
absolutely.
The incredible, we have very bad luck for many years with absence of photographs. Oh, it's worse than the Bigfoot situation, I'm sure. and we have hoaxes galore on YouTube. Oh, and we have misidentifications of frigate birds. I mean, I myself, personally, have a game camera that's set up for over a year, and I've looked through over 11,000 photographs. Not one of them shows a living pterosaur, but I know that the place where the game camera is set up is where two people have seen a ropan, I'm sure. So it's just we've had some bad luck for years, but we have good luck with these two artists. And maybe we can talk about these two people. This goes back a few decades.
Yes.
The first one was in 1965. But that's not the first one reported. That's just the first sighting itself. In 1965, and this is Guantanamo Bay, an American military base. And remember, this is just a few years after the assassination of President Kennedy, and there is there's still kind of secret. I don't know how secret now, but it was very secret at the time. The official commander at the base for a few years was not actually the one who's actually perhaps directing everything at the Guantanamo Bay. A few years after the Kennedy assassination of the president, John F. Kennedy. The man that was there was, name is Carson. He was aware of certain facts to deal with the assassination of President Kennedy. And he was sent there, and at least his children thought he was the boss. Maybe he was not actually running the place, but he had an important function there, and he took his family. One of his children was a girl. That was, maybe she might have been 5 years old at the time, pretty close to five. And her name was Patty. She still goes by Patty. Patty Carson, and she's agreed to have her name released. She was out there one day, clear weather, no obstruction to their view, with her little brother. And they were walking out toward the house on the base, the house where the family lived, and all of a sudden this creature pops up out of the grass. Now, the grass is not too tall. I don't recall what she said it was, but it was not very short either, and it was a scrub grass out there. and it stood up, and she got the impression that it just was awakened from sleep because it looked like it was not quite sure what was going on. It was looking around. I think they startled it. And after a few seconds, it flapped its wings, took off, and flew away. Now, Patty is very fortunate. She's one of these people, you know, that have this artistic ability where they can just remember what they see and they can make a sketch of it afterwards. Very few people have that, but it's a natural kind of artistic ability to just cast the details of what something actually looks like. Fortunately,
yeah.
She's one of those artists, you know, who has that ability. And she sketched it for me, even though it was many years later. She had no doubt that she just riveted in her memory these details. It had many teeth, very small, sharp teeth. The creature had a long snout. Now, this is, if you ever see the cover of my book, Searching for Opens, on the cover, this is the creature that's on the lower side that has a background of vegetation. It's below the water in the cover. It has a very long, slightly curved head crest, solid. Nothing at all can be thought of as feathery, obviously not feathers. And all these little teeth. Now, this is very important because it throws out some misidentification possibilities. Very few birds have anything that looks at all like teeth, especially not lots of sharp teeth. So that throws out a lot of things with misidentifications. So Patty Carson drew that for me, but maybe I better tell you how she found me. I better get into that detail.
Yeah, no, please do. I did just post a link to that picture that you were referring to.
Yeah, it's excellent photograph. It took her photograph. It's excellent sketch,
excellent,
which is almost as good as a photograph to my associates and I. Though of course, in a court of law, you can't use it the same like a photograph. But the important thing is how she found me. She had been watching some kind of one of these shows about, I believe it was Mothman or something, a Mothman documentary or show, and she thought, it reminded her that she had this sighting, and so she thought she'd look up anything on the internet that might be related to what she saw as a child. I believe that she probably got into Google search, and she used terms like, she used Cuba. And something else, I don't know if it's pterodactyl or something. Anyway, she said immediately she found this page. I'm pretty sure it was one of my pages because she sent me an email. She found this page that showed a sighting report by Eskin Kuhn, who was a Marine a few years later, 1971, U.S. Marine on the same base. And she was flabbergasted. She was shocked, and she sent me email, said that she saw it first in 1965. And she described it to me, and fascinating because it's not a gigantic creature like compared with some of them that I told you about, like the one in Lake Pung in Umbor Island, Papua New Guinea. Not nearly that big, but it's nothing that could be a misidentified bird. We come to, it had a long tail. She said it had a diamond at the end, and she described actually later when I questioned her in more detail, she said that the end of the tail had a flange that was oriented horizontally. You know, that there's been some, that's a long story we'll get into maybe, but anyway, in 1971, this U.S. Marine was there at the same general place on the base of Guantanamo, and he was out by himself in a break period, and he saw these two flying creatures, fairly close range. He said it was close. They were not flying too high. I can't recall offhand what it is. You can find it if you look it up online. Not too high up in the air, and he just was riveted to them because of the strangeness of the appearance of them. He called them pterodactyls at the time, and he also had this artistic ability, and so he concentrated to be sure that he remember it so that he could draw a sketch. Now, Mr. Kuhn, he went immediately, well, first of all, he tried to get the sergeant, and of course, by the time they got back out there, those creatures were all gone, so the sergeant saw nothing, but as soon as that was done, he went and he drew a sketch of these two creatures. That sketch is available online many places. Sometimes you'll see only one of them. I've taken one of them out and used one or the other. But the original sketch has two of them. And that one you can see on the front cover of my book, Live Pterosaurs in America. Third edition is the most recent edition of that book. But that one is the one where you see a flying creature over the water with the water in the background. But there's actually two creatures in the original sketch. Now, we can go into that if you'd like the details of that description.
Sure, sounds good.
Yeah. I don't want to, if you have something else in mind, just let me know. But basically, the sketch itself tells the whole thing, but he says that there was some hair on that flange-like at the end of the tail, so something like hair on that structure, though it didn't come out well in what we now have, the version we now have of the sketch. It was deteriorated somewhat, so you can't see it so much as a hairy structure, but he says there was something that looked like hair. He said it was extremely graceful. This is what I get from other witnesses, too. The flight of the creatures is, the flapping of the wings, extremely graceful. Let's see. I don't want to give you something from my memory that it cuts around, because there's a lot of it that's online, that's in reports and in my book, and I don't recall the details, and I might give you something wrong, but there's no doubt in his mind. There's no bird. It's not a misidentification of two birds. But the sketch itself correlates with Patty's sketch in certain ways. Not exactly. She said the wingspan was a little different in comparison to the size of the body, and she was able to see the mouth. But she was much closer, and she saw the creature when it had his mouth open. So it makes a difference. Eskin Kun saw the two creatures flying when the mouths were closed in flight. But there's the same area, and I'm always very interested when we have two sightings at two different days in the same place. We have some more of those, which especially this year, 2013, we have one in Los Angeles, in fact, in my own territory here. I'm always fascinated when we can get those where you have the same location. You know, doesn't necessarily mean anything, but sometimes it might. But the big problem we have with sightings in general in countries like the United States is that people don't report them. Most people don't want to talk about it. I give you an example. One of the eyewitnesses in Southern California, she reported to me a few years ago her sighting. And it was close to very, very close to a storm channel in Southern California in the middle of the day. And I got that sighting details. And then about a year later, just recently, I got another report from somebody who knew that person, but she had seen one a couple years earlier than the other one. And anyway, this other lady, she didn't say anything to anybody, not to her friends, not to her relatives. She said nothing to anybody because what she saw was like a dragon or like a prehistoric pterodactyl. So she didn't tell anybody until she heard that her friend had seen the same thing. Then she reported to the friend, who reported to me, and then I was able to interview her. So the challenge is that people just are so quiet. They don't want to tell people that they've seen one. We have more sightings than you could tell by the reports.
So you're the go-to guy, huh, for sightings?
Yeah, basically because I've been writing about so much for so many years, and I don't think there's anybody else in the world that can spend as much time about it as I have, because I'm just very fortunate that that's worked out. I know some people say it's a sign of insanity, but I'm not the one that sees pterodactyls. I'm not the one. I'm just the one that reports it, you know. But anyway, there's generally, they talk about insanity. There's very rarely any case where somebody has a sign of a mental health condition. That's rare. Basically, when I interview somebody, and I'm fortunate sometimes to talk to them on the phone, and get into details and so that they can talk freely. Generally, there's no sign of any health problem. There are rare exceptions, rare, and those are become obvious, you know. If a person has seen a real pterosaur, and this is a person that's healthy, the pterodactyl's not going to sleep at the end of their bed at night, and you know, it's just not going to happen. And they're not going to come when you call them by name or anything like that. You know, that's not what pterodactyls do.
Yeah.
there's a problem with the imagination of the human. You're not anything to do with the real relevant sightings. But generally, people are perfectly healthy. They just don't want to talk about it. Sometimes, though, a weird case comes up. I'll tell you one. Many years ago in the 1960s, my sister had a friend, and she was up in Altadena, which is above Pasadena, California, and she saw a huge pterodactyl, I think is the word she used. It was huge. She told my sister, of course, this is long before I had any idea about sightings of pterosaurs myself. I was a teenager myself at the time. And she told my sister she'd seen it, and my sister said, oh, it must have been something else, maybe a bird. She said, no. It was this, and when I finally, just in recent years, was able to interview this lady, who's now, of course, getting into old age, but I interviewed her, and she said it was as big as a school bus. It was no possibility of mistaking it for a bird. Sometimes I get a feeling that more people see these than we think. It's just that they don't report them to cryptozoologists or anybody else. So it's just I learn about this, you know, indirectly over the years by finding people like that who've had a sighting, but they would not ordinarily report it, you know.
Yeah. What's your take on the Thunderbird? Are you a believer in that, and do you think sometimes there's misidentifications with that as well?
Well, that's an excellent question to talk about. Thunderbirds, it's a word, of course. It's a label. You have to always be aware that labels sometimes are very limiting, and their usefulness in getting the truth of something. But Thunderbird legends from, and again, this is an English word too, so you know, it's translated from whatever the Native American language is. The Thunderbird legends, I believe, are based somewhat, sometimes, on pterosaur sightings, but not necessarily all of them. There might be actually very large species of bird that's not known to science that maybe was used to be common. I do occasionally get a report of a giant bird that has feathers, and I don't do much with it because it's not my specialty. I'm looking for living pterosaur reports. But I do get those, and I do get sometimes, you know, different ways I get to know a little bit about some of these legends or ideas about Thunderbird. And so it's hard to say. You know, just the word Thunderbird doesn't really help. You need to go to a specific sighting. What does somebody see, and how sure are they of the feathers and so on?
Yeah, because there's that one video on, well, they had it on Monster Quest, where the guy's on a river, and he actually filmed that giant bird. I mean, they didn't really have anything to scale it to, I don't believe, but it looked like a really big vulture to me.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing that, in fact. I think in that case, there's not any question of the type. It was a bird, but it's a question of the size. And it is, it's wonderful he got a video of it. I'm not sure if the experts were the best experts to make a judgment. I would recommend Cliff Paiva in California if somebody has a video like that and wants to, because he's a missile defense physicist, and he helps us a lot with our investigations of that have video and photograph evidence. His expertise is in analyzing images by computer and learning as much as he can about whatever was photographed or videotaped.
Yeah, because from what I remember, everyone kind of had a different opinion as far as what they thought it could be or what it was or how big it was. There was no cut and dry between all the different scientists and things in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we have to be realistic that, you know, sometimes if you have a sighting of a Bigfoot or a pterosaur a lot of times deciding what you can't really either get a good handle on whether it was real or not. It's just one of the problems you have. And one thing I do with that, though, that helps, if I have a report that looks like it probably was a pterosaur, if I give it a feeling that it was probably a pterosaur, even though it might be just 55% possibility, I keep that in mind, that that's a credible sighting. And at the end of last year, the end of 2012, I compiled 128 sighting reports of apparently pterosaurs, and I was able to do analysis on the statistics because I got so much information from some of these. And I got statistics that helped a lot and answered some questions about sightings in general. I don't know who's doing that with Bigfoot in that kind of analysis. You have so many sightings of Bigfoot. That could be quite a job. I can know from working with 128 it's quite a job.
Absolutely.
I could tell you some details about what I learned was that these are not, in general, these sightings are not from hoaxes. I'll give you an example. The eyewitnesses, when they tell me that there's no feathers, they have different ways of expressing that, and I can kind of judge by the way they say it how sure they are. For example, of those 128 reports, 21% were absolutely sure that there were no feathers on that flying creature that they saw. And this is like, for example, this is like the sighting we have of Professor Stephen Waters I talked to you about. But he's not on that 128 because he was, well, this year. I don't think I got it in time. Anyway, to go into that. But anyway, 21% say there's absolutely no feathers, but 25% say that they believe that there are probably no feathers. In other words, they express the possibility of doubt that it might have had feathers, but they didn't see any feathers, and they thought probably it's featherless. Now, that gives you a clue. You see, 25% is more than 21%. If there were a good number of hoaxes in those 128 reports, you would not have that kind of percentages of that kind of idea. You would have people trying to convince you that, oh, yes, no, definitely no feathers. I saw a giant pterodactyl, and, you know, if they're hoaxing it, they would say absolutely no chance that it had feathers because they're trying to make you believe that they saw a pterodactyl. So we know that there's not a huge number of hoaxes. Now, this doesn't say that nobody got a hoax sneaked a hoax in to the 120 reports. It's just saying that in general, there are not any significant number of hoaxes. There's also the wingspan, which is interesting. The wingspans are very, very evenly distributed from the largest to the smallest. There's no peaks or valleys to speak of anywhere. If people were playing hoaxes and sending me emails with hoaxes, you would have some type of clue based upon people's ideas, what they're trying to do, or ideas of how big pterosaur should be. In the United States, you know, they'd want to have it a big wingspan to show that it's not a common bird. You know, to try to convince me that they really did see pterodactyl, they might say a wingspan of 15 feet to 50 feet, a big wingspan. Well, there's no peak in the data at that level. If people are trying to convince me that they saw a long-tailed pterodactyl, Rhamphorhynchus, they would put it at a low rate, like something a small wingspan, which is similar to the fossils. They would say, oh, it had a 5-foot wingspan and had a long tail, but there's no peak at that level either. There's no peak at all. It's just an even distribution when there's reasons for that too, but that's complicated. I don't know if we get into that tonight. But basically, the feathers question and the wingspan question independently tell us that there's no major hoax influence.
Hmm.
And there's
largest documented bird in North America is the California condor, correct, at about 10 feet wingspan?
Yeah, there are some birds in other parts of the world that are bigger, but that would be something to be considered a really large bird, 10-foot wingspan. That's a big bird. But we don't have any kind of a peak or valley in the statistics anywhere around that range, above it or below it. It's just even. There's other things you can learn from the data. Basically, the overall data is very clear that there's no major hoax involvement. Most of these are not hoaxes. The great majority of them are legitimate sightings. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not any misidentifications. That's a whole different story. Misidentification of an individual sighting is comes up a lot with skeptics and people saying, oh, it couldn't be a pterodactyl, it has to be something else. But when you get to these, can we talk about that?
I was going to say, it brings up a good point in our chat room. We have a good following tonight, and some of the questions or points being made is that it could be something, maybe a bird with mange or a bat. You can't, with the size of what's being reported, I believe, and whatnot, and some with a tail, kind of rules out some of those.
Yeah. Now, do you need to do a station identification or anything now? It's not a case of that. Do you have it? You don't have to stop for any station ID or anything?
No, we try to keep it rolling.
Yeah, okay, great. That's a good statement. You have to always watch out for possible misidentification, and sometimes I do get those, particularly with the frigate bird.
Mm-hmm.
So we can go into details. Do you have any particular question or a particular sighting that anybody's interested in?
Well, the one I'm personally interested in is the one that actually occurred in was L.A. or Long Beach or in your general vicinity.
Yes, probably was Lakewood, which is very close to me, just a few miles from me. I was so excited to get that last year in 2012 because I can just drive over there and do everything right within the short driving distance, and that one was in about noon. It was very close to the middle of the bay. And as nothing obstructing the eyewitness's view, she had never, like this, this is common, okay? This next point is, I see a lot. The eyewitness had never heard about living pterosaur investigations or never heard that there were sightings or anything like that. She had no idea that there was such a thing as an investigation of live pterodactyls. But she contacted me, and I pretty quickly got over there and interviewed her in person. That creature, let me see if I can get the details, because I depend on my web pages and books for all this. Let's see if I have it handy.
Of course, yeah.
I don't see it right handy with the Lakewood sighting. I just have to do it by memory the best I can. It's easy to find if you Google it, the Lakewood Ropan or Lakewood Pterosaur, Lakewood Pterodactyl, and Lakewood, L-A-K-E-W-O-O-D. She saw at the end of a long tail, and remember this tail was right above her, the creature was on a telephone line sitting there, and she... I go back off space, okay? She heard strange noise. She was in her backyard on her computer. She was under a gazebo. And she heard a strange noise and thought her dog, Rex, a big black lab, was making some strange noises. And she looked at Rex, but Rex was barking at the same time, barking wildly. But she also heard this strange burping, gurgling kind of a noise. And so she stood up. And she walked over the dog and yelled, "What's going on?" or something like that. Yelled at the dog, and she got a feeling that the dog is not making a noise. And then she looked up and saw almost right over her was this creature that immediately got scared and flew off. But as it was right there above her, she saw the tail. I would estimate that the end of that tail of that animal was only about 18 feet from the nose of the eyewitness, right in front of her face. So she had a really close view. She said it was I don't remember exactly the word she used. I think it was diamond or triangle. I think she said triangle. Anyway, so one of those words she used to describe the flange at the end. And she said there's no feathers. The wingspan was not extraordinary. She thought it was very big, but, you know, as compared with birds, you know. The wingspan, I think she was estimating in the neighborhood of 5 to 6 feet. But it flew off, and it, she saw it flying into a tree and the next block or so, and hidden by the vegetation that it flew into. So that, you can't really get a misidentification too well with that. It's the tail, several feet long. I don't remember offhand how many. It was several feet, and she was very close to that tail. It was just right in front of her nose. So there's no real way you can get a misidentification on that in terms of a bird or bat. And that's, we have others that are similar. You just can't, there's no common bird or bat that's, known to science that, that would fit. It just doesn't fit.
So what, I mean, there's a lot of skeptics out there, obviously. What is some of the best evidence, I mean, it's just eyewitnesses we're talking about. Is there some better evidence out there for the proof of a living pterosaur?
Well, it's we're dealing with credibility issues, and there's four basic things we need to understand with credibility. The first one, I'll deal with this one first. All right, we have in our culture an idea that all dinosaurs and pterosaurs became extinct long ago. And the key to that concept is what I call universal extinction, the idea that all species of dinosaurs and pterosaurs became extinct millions of years ago. That's been ingrained to us since our early childhood in our culture, including the United States. I mean, it's something you would just take for granted. But that's not based upon any scientific test. If you really go back in history, if you interview talk to a paleontologist, I've done that more than once, they will never bring up something like, oh, in this particular year, so-and-so, a certain scientist did a certain test or anything. That extinction idea is never based upon something like that. So it's basically an axiom, something that's a foundational belief or assumption, a paradigm, something that's taken for granted in the scientific community, especially paleontology and biology. But it's not a scientific fact. But the problem we have is that that becomes a credibility issue with anything that resembles a pterosaur. And what my associates and I are trying to convey is the possibility that there are a few species of pterosaurs that are alive. Now, that doesn't mean that all these many different kinds of species of these two types of pterosaur from fossils are still living. It just means that there are a select group that are still surviving. Unfortunately, if you look at the records and if you look at large book on pterosaurs, I have a couple of them here that show you all these different varieties of head crests and sizes and all these huge varieties of species. Unfortunately, they're probably mostly extinct. That's the way it are, because there are just so many sizes, so many shapes that we would have more eyewitness accounts of those. What we have in the eyewitness accounts is fairly narrow. The head crests are usually horn-like. They're not these fancy, all these many fancy kind of big head crests. They're like a horn at the back of the head. Most of them have long tails with like the basal pterosaurs, but there's not the variety that we have in the fossils. So we're dealing with this one issue of whether or not there's universal extinction or whether it's not universal, whether it's a partial extinction. And that's the first part. Now, should we get to the next one?
Yeah.
The next one we'll go into is also based upon a generalized idea of sightings. That has to do with, is it possible that, I should have my notes here. This is a new concept I'm trying to get into. It's a general concept about the eyewitnesses in general. Is it possible that people have been, I better skip that because I haven't dealt with this sufficiently to get in my mind right. We'll go to the other two, okay? The other two deal with individual sightings, and I can deal with that. The first, I think we dealt with both of them. One of them is a hoax. Is a particular sighting a hoax? and we dealt with that. That well, you can't tell for sure. Some of them, there's ways that we could see it's not likely a hoax because people have been telling about this for years, and they've had to deal with accusations and so on, and they still keep telling the truth, like Eskin Kun. Nobody's given him a lie detector test, but boy, he's stood by his story for decades. Even when people accuse him of lying or something, he stands by it. He gets angry when people accuse him of lying. He's got good credibility in a number of ways. I talked to him on the phone once, and he was very credible to me. But there's also the case for an individual citing might be a misidentification. In other words, people are honest, but they made a mistake. Now, that kind, sometimes, you know, we have to deal with it. There's a possibility, but there are some sightings which are so clearly unusual, unbird-like, unbat-like, that there really there's not much reasonable chance that, like, for example, this one we talked about in Lakewood, California, there's no reasonable chance that that's a misidentification of a bird or bat. Sitting on the phone line right above her and then took off as she just started talking loudly. There's no misidentification there. It's not any kind of bird or bat that, you know, is known to science. So we have these different types of credibility issues we have to deal with. Now, let me see if I can get back to the point that brought that up. You were talking about... and I forgot the original question. It was about, do you remember what was somebody's question on that?
You kind of touched up upon it. I'd actually kind of like to move on a little bit.
Yeah.
Some of these sightings are recent, but there is petroglyphs, depicting... I think there's one in Utah, a pretty famous one, depicting like a pterosaur from the Native Americans. I'm sure you're well aware of that one, right?
Yeah, there's some petroglyphs. It's not my specialty, but yeah, I've seen them. That can be helpful if they're used together with eyewitness sightings. So there's the problem is if you deal with them just independently. The skeptics who are really convinced of the standard models were just to slough it off and just say it's just something else or it's just imagination of the artist or something. It's better to use those in conjunction with actual sightings of modern apparent pterosaurs. But it's not my specialty, so I can't really tell too much. I can say that there are historical evidences from... for example, the fiery flying serpent in the Old Testament. It's also in the Book of Mormon. Fiery flying serpent that was thousands of years ago with the ancient Israelites. And ideas about that, we can go into that and bioluminescence and so on, if that's some of the direction you want to go to.
Possibly. I was going to say, I know historians like Aristotle and Herodotus, said that, you know, in their history texts that they have seen flying reptiles and whatnot. There was one question I wanted to get to you about with some of these pictures that have come out within the last, I don't know, I think they've been around for a while, last 10 years or so, of some of these Civil War, seem to be like Civil War pictures of armed fighters standing on top of or around what looks to me like a pteranodon.
Two main ones that are very different, and I'm going to have to go by my memory here. They're very different in the very different situations. One of them, oh dear, I wish I had it in my computer right at the moment, but. Have it online. Now, one of them is an obvious hoax. It's based upon actually a film production or television production, and it was done for some kind of a show. And the, one of the men that's standing there is kind of having a little bit of a bulge on the stomach, and he's a little bit heavy set, which is very unusual for ordinary Civil War soldiers. Anyway, there's but there's another one that's a little more challenging. It's difficult to say what the origin is, because I have memories of something like that that go way back before there was such a thing as Photoshop. There might have been some Photoshopping done on that, but it might not necessarily mean that that's the origin of it. The second one, I can tell you a little bit about it from my memory. It has several apparent Civil War soldiers. They're standing in front of and behind this huge pterosaur-like thing, and the wings are very strange shape. Now, some people say, well, the wings look like just somebody took one or two canoes and put it like that to make it look like a pterosaur. They do look very strange. But the problem is that type of canoe is not found in the United States. It's sometimes you see them in the South Pacific, perhaps. But it's not the kind of canoe that was used. It's used in the United States. It's common here. And it doesn't exactly look like that canoe. You know, it's just a kind of a resemblance. So there is a question, is that really an authentic photo or not? I don't know. If it is an authentic photograph, it has been altered, though. Be aware that there has been alteration, which caused a problem with credibility.
Right.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily prove that it's a fraud, but whenever somebody does a Photoshop job or something and you can see that there's been an alteration in it, and you can't find anything any photograph that was taken or any image that was taken before that Photoshopping work, then that brings up the credibility issue as maybe the image came from a hoax. And that's a possibility here, but I can't really say on the second image. It's hard to say.
Okay. Well, it looks like we got a caller here. Let's take this call.
Hello?
864, you're live.
Yes, I'm Susan.
Hi, Susan.
Hello, Susan.
Yes, I'm from South Carolina.
All right.
Oh, Susan Wooten.
Yes. You remember
me,
Johnson?
How are you doing, Susan?
I'm doing fine.
Thanks for calling in.
Yes.
Great. Thank you very much for calling in. This is very important. Would you like to just talk about your sighting in South Carolina? I think I don't remember the highway number. It was on. A number of years ago. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes, Highway 20.
Highway 20, yes. Okay.
Yes.
And it's close to, what's the town it was close to? It was on the way from the, to Florence, or was it?
Yes, Florence and Bingham, down that way.
Oh, yeah.
It was in 1986 to 1989, somewhere in there. I don't remember that year. I didn't really tell anybody anything about it until my son got the internet many years later, and I was just typing in things on Google, and I typed in pterodactyl, and I came up with Jonathan's website and contacted him.
Well, glad you did.
Yes. I didn't tell many people because everybody thought I was nuts, so...
Yeah, I appreciate you. We're so grateful for your report. And all editions of my book, Live Pterosaurs in America, that's the beginning of chapter one, is basically your sighting there, Susan. We appreciate your sighting report. You do a kind of a crude sketch just to show generally the general basic characteristics of the creature. Maybe you could explain about what was happening. You had to be following somebody in a car ahead of you, right?
Yes. I was going back to college on one weekend, and it was about 3 in the afternoon. And a friend of mine was in front of me, and she was totally oblivious. She kept on driving, and it flew from the left side of the highway across two lanes and across the trees and then across my two lanes over my car.
Yeah.
Well, right in front of my car. And
I think if I picture it right, she was actually in front of the creature, so she would have to be probably looking in the rearview mirror to have seen it. Is that...
She never saw it. No, she was. She was kind of slinging along to the radio and kind of oblivious. That's the way she was.
Yeah. But, it was fairly low when it went over the highway, wasn't it? It was kind of low.
Yes. Well, in the center of the highway, there's a median with tall pine trees. This is out in the middle of swamps. There's nothing around.
I didn't know that.
For miles and miles.
Oh, so there are trees in the middle of the highway. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yes, very tall pine trees. And,
I see. Okay.
Nothing around for miles. You're just traveling. A lot of the lower part of South Carolina is rural, and nothing's out there. And it flew across the treetops, and it dipped down a little bit before the treetops in the middle, and then it dipped down again over my car, or right in front of my car, rather. And
so this is a highway that's kind of the two different directions of the traffic are kind of separated a distance.
Yes, two lanes on one side, two lanes on the other. It's a major highway, but like I said, there's nothing around.
Yeah.
For
so when it was, but it did come down a little bit when by the time it got over to your side of the highway, it was a little bit lower.
It dipped again. Yes. Okay. Kind of like with the air current.
Yeah.
I guess. I don't know.
So, Susan, can you describe a little bit about, was it gliding? Can you describe a little bit about, I mean, I don't know exactly what you saw, but what did it appear to look, I mean, I know you say pterodactyl, but, like, can you describe the color? Was it gliding, that sort of thing?
It was gliding, yes. And it really scared me because, you know, this is something you saw in dinosaur books, kind of thing. It really startled me. So my drawing is pretty rudimentary. I don't remember the exact details of the tail. I do remember that it had a head crest, and it was leathery. It had no feathers. Grayish in color, maybe brownish, but it was so startling. You know, I was glad I was in a car. I was not standing on the side of it because it would have scared me.
I can imagine. So, Susan, I'm trying to recall now. There have been a number of sightings that are similar to that more recently, and I don't want to get confused with yours. But if I remember, was there any angle to the? You say you had a long kind of mouth kind of structure, a beak or something, and that had a head crest. Was that kind of a curved shape from the beak back to the head crest? Was it a little bit curved, or wasn't it just kind of straight?
I don't remember if there was a crest. I mean, I know there was a crest, but I don't know if it was curved or if it was straight. There was a big crest behind its head.
And I'm probably confusing it with another sighting, okay.
Yes, and it's beak or whatever you want to call it, with the mouth, was very long. And the wings were very wide.
Yeah.
Did other cars see it as well, you think?
Yes, they did. Actually, a bunch of cars on the other side going the other direction stopped.
Wow.
And I went to the next exit and turned around and went back, and they were already gone. I wanted to get people's phone numbers and get their impressions, but they were already gone.
Well, that's a good point, Susan. We were talking about this concept that a lot of people don't report their sighting. Of course, that was way back when you didn't have the internet, you know, like we have now. But a lot of people don't tell us that they're sighting, even though there's obviously other people that have seen this same thing when you saw it. But they just kind of forget about it. By the time that internet comes along, they've kind of already forgot about the whole experience almost.
Right. Or they don't want to anything, because anytime I ever told anybody, I'm getting the same response.
Yeah, that's the problem. We get a lot, and not just Americans, but also Australians and the British and so on. It's the same problem.
Well, it's not like if you saw a Bigfoot, everybody believes that. But when you bring up something strange, a pterodactyl, they look at you like you're nuts. And
you know,
everybody's familiar with Bigfoot.
They're familiar with it, but I feel your pain. I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more part of a pop culture, whereas a pterodactyl, people probably look at you stunned, like, what?
Right,
isn't that Diota
right.
50 million years
yeah.
ago or whenever?
Yeah, and now I'm on on Google with my full name. And,
there
it is.
Yeah, I appreciate this, Susan. Yeah, appreciate that because it helps us people see that these are real people, not just something I've invented out of my imagination that I've talked to these people, that they're real people.
That's right.
And appreciate that very much. Now, you also have some experience with some strange lights that you saw flying around in a swamp, too, that you didn't correlate at the time to have any relationship to that.
I didn't until after I delved into your research a little bit and found out about the bioluminescence. And at the time, I was at college, and we used to go out to what was called the Bingham Lights in Bingham, South Carolina.
Yeah.
And they purported that it was a train engineer that lost his arm or his wife or something, and he had a lantern going up and down the swamp. And we would go out there and sit and watch, and sure enough, the lights would come. So we saw these lights, and as you've said, you know, 5, 6, 7 seconds, they would cruise through the swamp and then disappear.
Yeah.
And we all had a lot of fun with that because we were in college. But we sat out there many weekends because we had nothing else to do. We went to college in the middle of the swamp.
Yeah.
So,
Go ahead. Oh, I was just saying, this is an example of a number of different ghost light instances where we have different locations in the United States. There are other places, Tennessee, southern Louisiana, and other areas, where they have these legends of ghost lights. And when you go out there to the location, you actually see the lights. And that's
yeah.
important. You want to tell any detail about that you can remember, Susan?
Yes. We probably went out there every third weekend the entire time I was at college. And it never failed to happen. When we went, we never failed to see the lights, in other words. And we got scared a couple times because they came close to us.
Yeah,
but
somebody shot off a gun
see.
Once. I remember one day somebody shot off a gun.
Yeah, somebody pulled out a pistol and started shooting. And so I didn't go back after that.
Susan, I got a question from our chat room, or more of a point. They were
sure.
wondering if it was just gliding, I'm just going to read it right off here, if it was just gliding, if there was any up and down movement, or what exactly was organic about it? Were you just maybe possibly seeing a remote-controlled figure or kite of some sort?
Okay. Here's what the situation was. We were at a railroad junction in the middle of the swamp, and at this junction, it veered off at a T that went out into the swamp.
Well, I think he might be referring to the sighting in the highway where the creature flew over your car, I think. Is that what you're talking
about? I'm sorry.
I didn't see any light in the middle of the afternoon. No, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, he wants to know about how the creature was flying over the highway, Highway 20, I think is what the question is.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
No, it was mostly gliding, but like I said, it's like a bird some kind of raptor or something that was gliding with the. Down from the trees and then over the trees and then back over the trees again. It's a gliding motion.
So
I don't remember any flapping. No.
So in your opinion, it was probably. I mean. The question was kind of geared towards, was it, could you have possibly seen some sort of remote-controlled figure?
This was out in the middle of the woods in the swamp.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like your typical place to fly a kite or a
remote-controlled
plane or something.
No, I agree.
I don't think you could do that out there. It was too thick.
No, I agree, but that was just...
Yeah, South Carolina is really thick in the southern part. I've been through those areas, and it definitely... seems like Bigfoot country as well.
The lower part of the state is so rural, and there's nothing out
there. Lots of pine trees.
Right.
Yes, also, I believe, Susan, you did give an estimate of the wingspan. I don't remember what it was, but it was very big. What you saw was much larger than a...
About 15 foot or so. Yeah, it was huge.
Yeah, huge.
It dwarfed my car.
Wow.
That's what scared me, and I was glad I was in my car and not standing by the side of the road.
Yeah. Yeah, and also the important thing you mentioned about the lack of wingspan, when it was just gliding... It was gliding and changing altitude while it was gliding. In other words, it was it was gliding and came down and continued gliding as it ascended and got higher, which is not a something you see with a mechanical pterodactyl. But even though I'm not sure what they had back in the 1980s, what they had with mechanical pterodactyls in the 1980s.
Good point.
It was gliding like with the current of the wind. If you know what I'm talking about, the trees, the pine trees are so tall that it was at a great height, and it came down over the highway, over the two lanes next to me. I saw it. It went over those pine trees and then back down over my side and then back up to the trees on my side. And it was right in front of my car, about, say, 20 feet away. It was very close. So close, almost panicked. But
ticklish for comfort.
Very ticklish for comfort. If I were standing on the side of the road, in other words, instead of in a vehicle, it would have scared me.
Now, before we get too far, if anybody wants to hear a little bit more about the ghost lights, I can talk a little bit about that because ghost lights. See that I wish I could come to a firm conclusion about the. Those one Bingham lights. The challenge is that we have a competitor that's competing with Roben lights. We know from the research done by Fred Silcock in Australia, who's an expert in this, that sometimes there are certain barn owls. It looks like ordinary barn owls, but they still have a capacity to glow, a very light kind of glow when they're flying. So sometimes you have a ghost light that people say, well, it's kind of it's kind of wobbling, going up and down, back and forth over railroad tracks. Sometimes we believe those are caused by bioluminescent barn owls. Tidal alba is the scientific name for that bird.
Yeah.
And so when we have these descriptions in Bingham lights, now there's some similarities and there's some differences. So I've never been able to come to any firm conclusion as is this a Roben light or is it a a barn owl? I just wasn't able to do it because we didn't have enough information on that location.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I wish I could say for sure, but I just don't know.
As you know, that Matthew Pites here in South Carolina we were going to do a expedition down there, and the property owners would not let us. And then they later said that two guys that were hunting out there on ATVs were chased away by some creature, but they would not tell us what it was.
Oh, wow.
Like a barn owl.
I don't know. Maybe it was. I have no idea to tell.
No,
but
I hear people being frightened by large flying creatures when they're not in their car. It can be very terrifying, and I get a lot of reports of people being scared and running away or driving away from a large creature that's obviously not a barn owl. Yeah.
And you said this was near Florence, South Carolina?
Yes.
Okay.
And Bingham is B-I-N-G-H-A-M, lights. Bingham lights, you can Google it. And there may be videos for all I know now. I don't know, but it's private property now. It didn't used to be. And I really don't even know if it's connected. I only connected it after talking with Jonathan and thought, well, maybe this might be part of it.
Right.
Yeah. It's still worth keeping in mind, but I don't know if it's feasible now that property owners have a problem. We also have the Marfa lights in Texas, which is similar. We have a private property, and the owners of the property don't like just anybody wandering around on their land and scaring their cattle or something.
I can imagine. And Matthew wanted to try to trap one, and I said, in what?
Yeah.
What are you going to put it in, a transfer truck? And how are you going to catch it? And you can't tranquilize it. You don't know its weight. You don't want to kill it. So we never went. But
yeah, we sure appreciate your help with the student, because you've been an incredible incredible help with our investigations. And
Well, you're welcome.
I think I'll keep putting your sighting on chapter one in the future editions of my book.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. And appreciate you. Okay.
Great sighting.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you for calling in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Susan.
Well, looks like we got another caller here.
Okay.
501, you're live.
Yes, this is Laura. Hello, Jonathan.
Oh, hi, Laura. Laura, I don't know if I'm supposed to use your last name.
It's okay.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay, Laura, thank you for calling. I remember your sighting was in Arkansas, wasn't it?
Central Arkansas, yes, sir.
Arkansas, yeah. Central Arkansas?
Yes.
Okay. I have two important sightings in Arkansas, and I want to be sure I don't confuse them. Yours was, you were driving, right?
Yes, I was driving, and I live out in the country.
Yeah.
And I was driving to the grocery store, and it was in the middle of the afternoon in broad daylight in 2002, April of 2012, excuse me. And I was driving over a bridge as water underneath.
Yeah.
And I saw something out of the passenger window of the truck. And it was a creature coming up from underneath the bridge, flying up from underneath the bridge. And it flew up beside my truck and over it and out into the woods. But I watched it as it flew the whole time.
Yeah, you had a fairly close view, if I remember right, from your report to me. It's fairly close. You got a good view of it.
It was the tip of its left wing, which was what I was looking at when it came up on the passenger side of my truck, was about 5 to 6 feet from me, probably.
Yeah. And it had something that was unusual about the wings, too, if I recall. They're sectioned, kind of a sectional appearance.
Yes. They were flat wings, kind of like an airplane's wings,
yeah.
And there were like three sections to them.
Yeah.
And they looked kind of like an elephant skin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that.
No feathers whatsoever, just skin.
Uh-huh. Now,
and
when you said
gray.
You gave me an estimate about what the wingspan would be from wingtip to wingtip for that, but I don't remember what it was.
I would say the wingspan from tip to tip probably would have been a minimum of 14 feet.
14, yeah. So in other words, one wing could have been a neighborhood of 7 feet perhaps for one wing, and then 14 for the 2 feet?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, your sighting is very unusual in the details. I don't recall any other sighting that I've received over many years of with that kind of a wing. So you might have seen a really rare creature. I don't know. It's probably a pterosaur, but it's not the typical one that we usually get. So it's keep it on file and watch out for other reports that have that and see what we can find out.
Right. Well, I think the torso of it might have been about 4 or 5 feet or so long.
Four or five feet long?
I saw it really close.
Yeah. You didn't notice any legs? I don't recall if you said that.
Yes. It had, I saw the legs, but by the time I could see the legs, it was up above my truck, and I was looking out the front windshield.
Yeah.
And the legs were, you know, I guess just kind of floating in the air as it was flying behind it, underneath the tail. The tail was not long, though. It was kind of short. But it had that spade or diamond shape at the end of the tail.
Oh, yeah, that is unusual. I mean, not unusual that it had that on the end of the tail, but it wasn't described as long. Usually get a long tail. But there are different
right.
types of pterosaurs. There are many different types we know from fossils and different shapes and so on. So we're definitely going to keep this on file and see if we can see another sighting report of something similar that is unusual. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think you had the same problem with Susan Wooten as you were. You went back and you found out this private property was the problem, and you couldn't really do
right.
any investigation because of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it had a crest on the back of its head too, and the crest was shaped kind of like an anvil hammer. You know, it had that
curve. Anvil hammer. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, curved kind of shape. Now, this is important. We need to talk about this anvil-shaped head crest because, if I recall, Laura, when you were making the sketch, you were concentrating on a lot of different things, and you forgot to put the head crest on it, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I forgot to put it on there, and I couldn't exactly remember exactly what shape it was. But on a blog, somebody wrote something about them. They saw the head crest on one of them, and it was anvil hammer shaped. And I went and took the anvil hammer out of my toolbox and looked at it. That was it. It had the little curve. It wasn't straight like a horn, you know, would be. It had that curve in it.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, we did have one from Georgia that has a lady who actually had two sightings in a period of a few weeks. And she described a kind of a curve to that head and head crest. Yeah, it's interesting. Uh-huh.
Well, I got a good close look at its face when it was coming up beside the truck, and I was looking out the passenger window, and I could see its bill, and I saw no teeth. Its bill was closed.
I could see
its face. It was gray, kind of a medium gray, and
the
I saw
head was
its
gray.
Eye. I saw it.
Oh, you saw one
eye?
One eye
I saw.
Okay.
And it was gold. And it looked, it reminded me of a cat's eye.
Uh-huh.
That kind of an eye.
Huh. So
gold.
You could actually see a color in the eye?
Yes. It was gold or goldish brown.
Yeah.
That's a close encounter.
Yeah, it was a real close encounter. And I'm very glad I was inside my truck. It reminded me of a. It looked like a small airplane. That was the size of it, like a small airplane. That's how big it was.
Yeah.
And,
well, yeah.
Excellent.
This is one of the kind of sightings that's very common in the United States is somebody's driving a car or a truck and they get a sighting of a apparent pterosaur flying over the car or in front of the car very often, and it's very common. And the ones that actually report to me, like Susan and Laura here, I believe those are the people that actually have seen the pterosaur, most of them, and those two especially, have seen some type of pterosaur.
Hmm.
Well, I think that the animal from the tip of its head to the tip of its tail was maybe, I don't know how many feet for sure, but I'd say 9 to 12 feet.
Okay. Can you compare that, like, to the wingspan so it would be a little bit less... distance from the end of the beak to the end of the tail, a little bit less distance than the wingspan?
Yeah, well, the wingspan would have been about 14 feet across.
So it'd be a little less.
Both wings.
Yeah.
But that would be, okay, but from the tip of the head to the tip of the tail would have been like 9 to 12 feet long.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, that's helpful.
And the only way I had to judge that was by looking at my truck.
Yeah,
I had to look at my truck to judge, you know, where or how big the animal would have been in relation to that.
Yeah. Well, also, Laura, there's something significant. You told me about the way that it was flying. Tell everybody the way that it was flying, the impression you had about the weight of the creature.
Oh, that was the most fascinating thing. It wasn't flying. It didn't glide, or I didn't see it glide. It actually flapped. It's like flapping the wings. And it was like in a wave motion. there were like three sections to the wing. I mean, I was underneath it looking up at it by that time. And I could see each of the sections working in unison like a wave. And it would flap. I can't really describe it, but it did flap. It didn't glide.
Yeah, it was flapping. It was okay. Ascending, right? It was coming up out of the underneath the culvert or the
right. It was coming out from underneath the creek. Yeah, the bridge.
So it looked like it was trying to gain altitude and just get up in the air.
Yes, it looked like it was really hard for it to. It was so huge that it looked like it was having a hard time getting up in the air. I mean, it was really flapping its wings, trying to push itself on the air to get up.
Yeah, this is another unusual point about this sighting. This creature was kind of heavy set and it was having trouble struggling. That's interesting.
Well,
amazing.
I imagine it was trying to get away from my throat and get away from me. So it was really struggling. It was trying to get up in the air. It made it. But it was heavy. I couldn't hear it. I could hear it a little bit, even though my windows were up. I cracked my windows a little bit in the truck, and it's like I could hear the force, kind of feel the force, the pressure of the wind, of the air that was beside my truck trying to get up into the air.
Oh, wow.
It was kind of pushing it. I don't know how to describe it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's incredible. Thank you very much, Laura. We really appreciate you calling
in. You're welcome.
People know that these are real people, that you're a real person that is.
No, really appreciate it. Love eyewitness encounters joining us here and sharing their encounters, and really appreciate you calling in, Laura.
You're very welcome. Y'all have a good week.
All right.
You too.
Bye bye.
Johnny.
Okay, it looks like our good friend J. Michael Cooney, author of Bizarre Zoology Blog, is with us. Jay, are you there?
Yes, I am. Do you guys hear me through?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you, Jay.
I just had some questions for Mr. Whitcomb.
Okay.
And one of the things I was wondering is that how does he think that these animals exploit their niches when modern birds and bats have allegedly taken the niches that Mesozoic pterosaurs had?
Oh, well, that's a deep question. Boy,
yeah.
I guess we could let's see how we deal with that. All right, this has to do with niches. Now, this is the problem we have is we don't have extensive videos of pterosaurs that are catching food and dealing with competition and dealing with different problems in life, so we don't really have much to go by. It's kind of speculation. even the locations, you know, a creature that size can be traveling long distance. And somebody wants one of the easiest things I have is, well, how did, when somebody asked me, how did the pterodactyl get into the storm drains in Southern California, Los Angeles County? And the easiest way is, well, maybe they came here from Mexico, but the fact is there's lots of places to hide all over North America for a nocturnal creature to hide. So, but the question about how do they deal with their niches and so on is something I hope someday that we can learn about, but I'm afraid it's way too soon to get into that.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's good to think about this. I don't have data that can really help. I'm basically my work is trying to establish basic type of creature that these are and comparing different sightings to see what they are. How they are is something totally else, how they live, I don't know.
All right, Jay, you got any other questions, Jay?
Yeah, I was wondering, do the reports involve any of the features that we think we know about pterosaurs from the fossil record, such as the fuzz-like integument or their quadrupedal movement on the ground?
Oh, I can tell you a little bit of a few sightings about that. Give you an example. I mean, this the Ropan of Umboy Island, for example, there was a sighting that was reported in one of the earlier expeditions in the 1990s, and the sighting involved two men who witnessed a Ropan that was holding onto the tree trunk, and as it was holding onto the tree trunk, it turned its head to look down at the men. Now, the men had some fish at the time. I don't remember if they were cooking fish or not, but they had fish that they had caught. And that was kind of, I found kind of interesting because, you know, flying foxes, they hold themselves upside down from tree branches, that this is the flying creature that was holding itself onto the tree trunk in an upright position with the tail down, you know, head up, upright. So that's one of the things that we've learned a little bit about, just that. Now, you're talking about mostly, you want to make questions about how they move. It's similar to things we know from the fossils. We know that from the surveys done a few weeks after my expedition, by the second expedition in 2004, that there's a strong correlation with the Sordis pilosus general shape. Not the size, but the shape. We had two eyewitnesses that had a good enough view that they were able to compare all these different silhouettes of birds, bats, and pterosaurs. And out of those dozens of images, they both chose the same one. Both men chose the Sordis pilosus as the image. So we suspect that there is a close relationship between the Ropan of Umboy Island and the Sordis pilosus of fossils, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the same species, but it's just a close correlation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Great questions, Jay. Thank you, as always.
Very good.
I don't know if you're done yet or if you're going to keep rolling. You're a smart guy and love your questions. I don't know if you got any more.
You might, if I ask a few more. I have
a
little list written down, actually.
Go right ahead.
I was wondering if you've heard of the, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Orangbati sightings in, I think, somewhere in Indonesia or New Guinea or somewhere like that.
Yeah, the Orangbati. In fact, I have a website by that name,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't been able to get much information from that area. There's much less that I have, and I've never been there myself, to that part of the Southwest Pacific. We have a problem here. As this name comes up, the Orangbati, when somebody uses that name, what we really need to know is a particular sighting. What did somebody actually see? What did it look like? Did it have feathers or not, or is it unsure? Have a long tail? Those are the things that are critical, but a legend by itself is very limited use unless you just want to use it kind of as a stepping stone, you know, to look for eyewitnesses. I really can't tell you too much about her.
Okay,
it sounds wonderful.
You.
I love the name. I have a dot com with that name, but just we haven't been able to get enough eyewitness accounts from that country. It's east of, I mean, it's west of Papua New Guinea somewhere.
And then just my last question, I was wondering, do you think that there's any chance that some of the eastern United States sightings of the Jersey Devils might be pterosaur-based? Because I have seen some comparisons of different eyewitness sketches with reconstruction
morphodon. I think it's an excellent question. I've heard that before. It's an excellent question, something to look at. I believe that some sightings that are labeled with the label of Jersey Devil are in fact pterosaurs, and that doesn't mean that all of them. But again, we have the problem with labels. You know, people call it this and that, and then you try to say, well, how can it have all these things, different characteristics? Maybe it's different things that are people seeing. You know, that's a challenge. They really always concentrate on a particular sighting and the descriptions of it, and not get carried away too much with the. With the labels of it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Jay, for calling in, and you know, you've been a guest here before, so thank you so much for calling in, and asking our guest Jonathan some very good questions here. So appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. All right, bye.
Thank you.
See you later, Jay.
Yeah. Bye.
So Jonathan, we only have like 6 minutes left or so. I would like to know what you have planned for the future, what you know, exploits you're going to partake in, and you know, and what you want to see come from your research, besides the obvious, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I want to promote an atmosphere where people can communicate openly. I really appreciate this, these 2 hours, and it's just been a great experience for me and a good opportunity to communicate about different perspectives. But people need to be more open to communicate with those that might not have the same assumptions or origin philosophies or so on. But people need to communicate and be able to talk about experiences, compare their different ideas. Regarding specifically more of the pterosaur searching, I hope to get some videotape evidence within the next year or so, based upon a particular location. I don't want to go into details about the location, but
oh, yeah.
A particular location where I want to do some videotaping, day and night both, and hopefully get, I hope I can get something in the next year or two. So I hope and get that evidence. And then eventually, if I can be of assistance to some of my associates, I should say, I don't know, one or more associates who are very actively involved in a different secret area where they're hoping to capture a live pterosaur. And I haven't been invited yet to participate with that, but I would certainly be delighted to be part of it. But that does have some potential in the next year or two for capturing actually a live pterosaur. They're progressing with their techniques and so on. And so and be aware that there might come a time when we have a pterosaur in the zoo, and it might be within the next 2 or 3 years.
That would be phenomenal. You know, I'm not discounting anything. We're very open here at Monster X. That's why we love having very educated and people like you on the show.
Thank you.
Got any more trips planned for Papua New Guinea or anything like that?
Well, so much happening in the United States, I think I'd probably stay here.
Yeah.
I mean, I learned the language, and I'd gained some friends there, and I hate to say it, but I'm afraid that one expedition might be my only one, because I really have lots of opportunities to work here in North America. And I do have, there is some work in Mexico. I can't divulge any name or a particular part of Mexico or any particular dates, but there has been some progress with searching for a living pterosaur there.
Wow.
That's not the name of the country, and Mexico is not a secret, but it's very important that nothing else be revealed about location or time schedule or names of anybody. But, yeah, things are progressing. I have wonderful contributions from researchers who don't go expeditions themselves but do wonderful research. Richard Muirhead from the United Kingdom, who got me to get in touch with this book about Evelyn Cheeseman, the British biologist. That kind of thing is very important, too. I'm very grateful for those who are eyewitnesses and also researchers who give me information. I'm very grateful for them.
That's awesome. Well, I guess we're down to our last minute or so here. So, you know, I'd like to thank you for being our guest, Jonathan. I personally learned a lot, and yeah, you've sparked my interest in a new cryptid now, and I'm going to have to look into more of your material.
Great, thank you.
And thanks, Susan and Laura, for sharing your encounters. It was great to hear those. And
yeah,
thanks, Jay, for calling in.
Yeah, that was
and
great.
Thanks,
great question. I'm sorry I couldn't do more in answering Jay's questions, but I appreciate it.
Oh, you did a good job. And thanks to everyone in the chat room for joining us tonight. And we'll hope to see you next Sunday as well.
Thank you very much.